All right, so this is Bio 241. It's February 3rd, and we're going to start Chapter 6 today. And let's see, I think we're scheduled to have a test next week. All right, when is the test scheduled? Tuesday. Yeah, it's scheduled for Tuesday, and it's going to be over Chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. All right, 1, 2, 3, and 6. So let's get started with 6, unless somebody has any questions over the previous stuff. Anybody have any questions? No? Okay. Make sure in lab you go over those quantitative questions at the end of the chapter. Every chapter has got like two or three quantitative questions, and so bring your calculator to the test too. So I'll probably have a real easy quantitative question on the test, which might be very similar to what you see in the back of your book right there. Okay? Say that again? Okay, so just... standard scientific non-graphing calculator is what you need, right? Which means any kind of cheapo calculator. And it should be bright enough in here so that if you have a solar-powered calculator, it would probably work, okay? All right, so let's see. This is what we're going to talk about in this chapter. Make sure I get the microphone on. We're going to talk about the extracellular environment, right? What's surrounding cells. We're going to talk about how things move from the extracellular environment into a cell through the plasma membrane. That's the separation between the extracellular and intracellular compartment. And osmosis of membrane transport systems. We're going to talk about the membrane potential. And anytime you see this word potential, you should also think of the word potential as being voltage. All right, so every cell has a voltage associated with it. So potential and voltage are the same terms, and then cell signaling. All right, so before we get going about talking about movement of substances across the plasma membrane, let's talk about the extracellular environment, right? That's everything outside the cells, right? So it includes all constituents of the body outside of the cells. And we can furthermore break the extracellular environment into two locations, two components or two compartments. Those two compartments, right, can be either the interstitial fluid that we find around cells or the blood plasma. And the plasma, of course, is not contained within a cell, and the interstitial fluid is outside of cells. So the extracellular fluid is what? Composed of interstitial fluid plus blood plasma. Of all the extracellular fluid, 80% is interstitial and 20% is in the blood. So most of it is surrounding cells on the outside of cells. And the extracellular component or compartment is 33%, right? And the water inside cells comprises 67% of the water inside your body. Okay, so here is sort of a tissue diagram. Here we see a blood vessel, we see plasma inside a blood vessel, and then we see connective tissue right here. So for instance, this would look maybe like a fibroblast, and here's another fibroblast at some distance from the first one. So this is just a matrix of a connective tissue, and it contains water as well. This is what we call the interstitial space, right? And here's the blood plasma. So if we take the interstitial fluid and blood plasma, that's what we call extracellular fluid. And then the intracellular fluid, right, is what we find inside cells. And all of these things are linked together by various kinds of fibers, like collagen fibers, which we see right here, which are these big, thick ones, and elastic fibers. And then there are other protein fibers that stick through membranes of cells, which we call integrins, and they are attached to the fibers of the matrix, and so all these cells are kind of held together and in place. And then there is like a jelly-like material within the matrix of connective tissue that holds water as well. It acts like a sponge for holding water. And those are made out of glycoproteins or proteoglycans, or sugar proteins that can remain hydrated and hold water. Okay, so that's something about the extracellular fluid. Let's talk about movement across a plasma membrane. All right, the plasma membrane of a cell is what we call selectively permeable or semi-permeable. It lets certain molecules to move across the membrane, but not every kind of molecule. All right, so certain molecules have to have transporters or channels to move across the plasma membrane. So carrier-mediated transport involves a specific protein transporter. So what kind of molecule can move through a plasma membrane? What's the best description in your mind of a plasma membrane? What's the building block of a plasma membrane? The phospholipid, right, bilayer. And so the internal part of that membrane, what's the nature of the internal part? It's nonpolar, yeah. It's a lipid. So polar molecules can't move across a plasma membrane because they can't move across that lipid layer, right? But polar molecules certainly can enter or leave a cell. In order for that to happen, they have to have a transporter. There has to be a protein that will carry them across. Or there has to be a tunnel or a channel through which those molecules can move through the plasma membrane. But they can't directly move through the plasma membrane because of that lipid layer. So there are two ways, general ways, that you should think about membrane transport in the most general sense. And the two ways are either passive transport or active transport. Passive transport moves compounds down a concentration gradient and it requires no energy. That's what passive means. Active transport, on the other hand, means that it requires energy of some kind in order for that to happen. And what is the most readily available form of energy inside your cells that's used is ATP, right? So active transport will require ATP. Okay, so what you should always remember is how things will move according to a concentration gradient, whether it's active or passive. So I always kind of think of a car I was driving when I was in college, and it was, I think, a 1968 MGB, which is a really small car. It's a little bit bigger than this desk right here, but it was not very reliable. It was a lot of fun to drive, had a stick shift, so it was really sporty, but sometimes after work or school, the battery would be dead, so I'd put the key in the ignition, I'd turn the ignition, and it would just go, how would it go if the battery's dead? It would just go click, 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 and then I couldn't go home. Or the starting motor was rusted out or some kind of problem with the car. So I learned, if I wanted to go home, where did I have to park? On the top of a hill, right? So even if I couldn't turn the engine over, all I had to do is stick my left foot out the car, right? Put the clutch in, put it in first gear, and give the car a little kick, and what would my car do? It would roll down the hill. Does it require gasoline to roll down the hill? No. So is this an active or passive process of my car rolling down the hill? That's passive, right? So passive just means, in terms of even molecules moving, means that they will move from high to low concentration all by themselves. Right? So now what about my car if it was down here at the bottom of the hill? Would it automatically roll up the hill all by itself without gasoline? No. It needs energy to do that. So this is what we call what? An active process. And what is the molecule that we need for active processes in us? That would be ATP. Okay. So those are the two kinds of ways things can move across the membrane. They can go down a concentration gradient or they can go up a concentration gradient. If it's down, it happens automatically. If it goes up, all right, or against the concentration gradient, it requires energy to do that. All right, so when we start to talk about some of this stuff, I want to make sure that you all understand some terminology and that what the heck is a solution. So let's talk about a solution for just a little bit. A solution has two parts to it. It has the solvent, which is the major constituent of a solution, and it has a solute, which is the minor constituent of a solution. All right, so what have you used? Let's see if we can figure out some examples so that you have a good feeling of what a solution is. All right, what have you used as a solvent today? What have you used? Water. What did you use water for? Took a shower, sure, okay. So you dissolve things off your body, for instance, okay. What else would you use water for? Yeah, to make coffee, for instance, right? So coffee is part solvent, which is the water, and what's dissolved in that water? The solute is all the coffee particles, and maybe what else did you put in there? Maybe sugar, for instance, that would be a solute. The cream would be a solute, because there's calcium and lipids, right, in cream. So those would be solutes. So water is a very good solvent to use. And what solutes have you used today? We just said. Like, for instance, like sugar that you put in the coffee or tea or whatever. All right. Now, what is the major solvent in your body? Is water, right? We saw that on the previous slides. And what are some important solutes in your body? Like calcium would be a good one. Calcium levels have to be regulated in your bloodstream. What else has to be regulated in your blood? Glucose, right? If you can't regulate glucose, we call that diabetes mellitus. And also oxygen would be a solute. Carbon dioxide would be a solute. These things dissolve in plasma as well, or the fluid compartments of your body. All right, now here's kind of a strange question. What is a minor solvent in your body? There's a location where we don't find water. There's something else. Okay. Think of bones. Yeah, that's a solid. That bones are solid. So remember, a solution is solvent, which means that it's some kind of liquid. So I don't know if I like bones necessarily because they're solid. Muscle. Yeah, there's a lot of water in muscle. But think smaller. Remember this thing? The phospholipid bilayer right here. And what do we got on the inside of this membrane? This lipid layer. And guess what can dissolve in this layer right here? Other kinds of lipids. Like, give me an example of a lipid that can dissolve in this layer right here. Like cholesterol. So I want you to kind of be aware that this layer is in all your cells, right? And it acts like a solution as well. And what kinds of things can dissolve in this are lipids, like cholesterol, for instance. Okay? Or hydrophobic compounds can dissolve in that part of your body. But that's a very minor solvent in your body. All right, so what can dissolve in this solvent? Well, we just gave an example. All right? Well, this minor solvent would be anything that is hydrophobic. And in particular, that would be cholesterol, can dissolve within the phospholipid bilayer. Okay, so let's talk about a process by which molecules can move around, and that's diffusion. All right, so diffusion is just a random motion of molecules. As a matter of fact, temperature is really the random motion of molecules. As you increase the temperature of a compound, the molecular motion increases. So, for instance, if you have a beaker of water and you put it on a hot plate and the temperature increases, guess what happens to those water molecules, the motion of those water molecules? They increase. And if you increase the temperature, then the speed of those molecules or the velocity increases. And if you increase it past 100 degrees, guess what happens to the speed of those water molecules? They're so fast, what happens to them? Yeah, they jump right out of the water because they're moving so fast. So we call that boiling, right? So temperature is really just a measure of how fast molecules are moving. And since molecules are moving, they have a tendency just to stir themselves up. So for instance, if I had a perfume bottle right here in my hand and I open up the perfume bottle, it would evaporate into the air around the bottle, and then that perfume would move. As a matter of fact, I can smell the marker already, okay? And why is it that these molecules are moving? Because do we see a fan anywhere blowing the molecules around? There's no fan, all right? So molecules will move from high concentration to low concentration. So these perfume molecules, could never sell it if it was perfume. But, okay, where is there a low concentration of perfume? Like in the corner of the room. Right, or the corner of that room. So this perfume is just going to move from here. People in the front row are going to smell it first, and then the second row, and then the third row, right? And then sooner or later, everybody in the room is going to be able to smell that perfume. Okay? And if we close the doors and come back in a couple days, what are we going to find? Just a uniform perfume everywhere in the room, Right? And when the concentration is the same everywhere in the room, diffusion stops. So diffusion is the fastest when the gradient is the biggest. And that's when? Right when we open up the perfume bottle. So things are going to diffuse fast. And as molecules fill up the room, the rate of diffusion slows down. But what you should always think is that molecules will move from high concentration to low concentration passively, all by themselves, not requiring energy. All right, so if we have a beaker right here, and let me just read the slide really quick. Let's just say net movement from region of high to low concentration. Let's just say that the blue right here is just the solvent, so that would be water, and these dots right here represent the solute, so that could be a salt or a sugar or something like that. And maybe there's a little bit of a membrane right here, so we can put a very concentrated solution on the left-hand side and a weakly concentrated solution on the right. And so these salt particles are just going to move from left to right because there's a big concentration gradient. And does that require energy for that to happen? Absolutely not, right? That's just passive diffusion. And what happens to the rate of diffusion when the concentration on the left is equal to the concentration on the right? Then the net diffusion goes to zero. The concentration gradient is gone. So as many molecules that move from right to left move from left to right, and there's no net diffusion. All right, so diffusion stops at that point in time. And it's highest, the rate is highest, right at the beginning, because that's when the concentration gradient is the highest as well. All right, so our body takes advantage of that physical chemistry, that just natural process of our universe that we call diffusion, because, for instance, here is a cell, and cells need oxygen molecules. There's an organelle that needs oxygen. What organelle is that? Mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP, for instance. So these blue dots right here represent oxygen. So oxygen moves into cells just by diffusion from the air around us. Right? So if oxygen moves into our cells by diffusion, where is oxygen concentration the highest? Is it in the air or is it in our cells? Okay, because oxygen can only go from high concentration to low, so oxygen concentration has to be high in the air and low in the cells, otherwise oxygen would never get to our cells. All right, so you do have to think about that. That seems a little strange. All right. Now, your cells, or the mitochondria, then produce CO2. And we excrete CO2. Our cells have to get rid of CO2. And here you can see CO2 leaving a cell, and we breathe that out of our body into the air. So tell me about the concentration gradient of CO2. Where is it highest? In a cell, or is it in the air? It's in the cell. Right, because if CO2 was high in the air, CO2 would never leave our body. It would be trapped inside our body. We have no way to excrete CO2 otherwise. And it's fortunate that the concentration of CO2 in the air is almost zero. So there's a big concentration gradient for CO2. So it's very easy for our bodies to get rid of CO2. Okay, so that's how gas exchange takes place. All right, now some molecules, for instance, like these ions right here, these are charged particles, and charged particles can't move through this hydrophobic region of the plasma membrane all by themselves. They're excluded. All right, so in order for ions and other kinds of polar compounds to move either from outside the cell to inside or from inside to outside, there has to be certain proteins embedded in the membrane that can act as a channel or maybe a transporter. And what we see on this slide right here is an ion channel. And so this channel is open, and this molecule right here, let's just say that's a sodium. Which way is the sodium going to go? From outside to inside or inside to outside? It's going to go from outside to inside, just down its concentration gradient, right? From high to low. So it's going to move from right to left. And furthermore, cells have the ability to close these channels or open these channels to regulate the movement of these ions across the cell. And we're going to see how that happens quite a bit. All right, now, I don't see a transporter here. I'll show you a transporter in just a little bit. All right, so the rate of diffusion, we've used these terms before, directly related or inversely related. All right, in terms of maybe pH. How is the acidity of a solution related to the hydrogen ion concentration? Directly related or inversely related? Acidity and hydrogen ion concentration. All right, as hydrogen ion concentration goes up, acidity goes up. It's directly related. Now, what about pH? As hydrogen ion concentration goes up, what happens to pH? It goes down. It's inversely related. All right, that's just due to the pH scale. All right, so the rate of diffusion is directly related to the magnitude of the concentration gradient. So as the concentration gradient increases, the rate is faster. That just means when the concentration gradient goes away, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It stops, right? It goes the same direction as the concentration gradient. So this is probably the most important thing that you're going to be considering in this class and lab, and that is a concentration gradient. Right? Also, if it's moving through a membrane, that membrane has to be permeable to that particular substance. If it's impermeable, then that substance won't be able to move through that membrane, and it might be some degree in between. Right? But nonetheless, it's directly related to permeability. Diffusion is also directly related to temperature. So as the temperature increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases as well because the molecular motion increases. They get stirred up faster as the temperature increases. All right? And also, the surface area of the membrane is directly related to the rate of diffusion through a membrane. And I think I did it with this class, but I'm not sure. But in everyday language, how should you think of surface area? Doorway, right? I measure that doorway over there. As the doorway gets bigger, more things can move across it. Right, so as the surface area of a membrane increases, of course, diffusion is going to increase as well. And then there's one thing that is inversely related, and that is molecular weight. And molecular weight is just the size of a molecule. And I think you did this in the first lab where you looked at the diffusion of potassium permanganate and methylene blue, and I think the methylene blue is a big molecule. Did you guys do that experiment already? Yeah, okay. So the smaller molecule diffused faster, and you controlled for what temperature, right? And the concentration was about the same of those things. Molecular weight is just the size of the molecule. The smaller it is, the faster it will diffuse. So you could think of maybe me on my motorcycle at a stoplight. Kind of waiting for the light to turn green, and right next to me is a semi-tractor trailer. When the light turns green, who's going to make it through the intersection first? Is it going to be me or the big truck? Yeah, because I'm on a really light motorcycle, right? So think of molecular weight in terms of motion that way.
Can a molecule use both diffusion and transit membrane pores to get in faster?
Okay. The membrane pores are those membrane channels right here. Okay. Either allows or disallows the motion of that molecule, okay? And the driving force is going to be the concentration gradient. So there could be a high concentration gradient, like maybe what I see right here, but if there are no channels in the membrane, it can't get through. It's only when that channel opens up that that molecule then can start to diffuse through the membrane. That when the channel opens up, that increases the permeability of the membrane. All right, so I kind of like your question, but I answered it a little bit differently. All right? Okay. All right, well, if that didn't help you out, ask me again another way, okay? Okay. All right, so now we're going to talk about osmosis. All right, there are three important criteria for something to be osmosis, and I'm just going to talk about it for a little bit, and then we'll go back and answer what those three criteria are. Okay? So osmosis is the net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. So that's pretty much the whole definition right there, but that's really a loaded term. Because what does diffusion mean? What does diffusion mean? What are some important things about diffusion? It is active or passive? It's passive, which means things can move from where to where? Only from high to low, right? Okay. And the selectively permeable membrane just means that the membrane will allow certain things through, but not everything. So here we have a model of two compartments separated by a membrane. And if we look at this molecule right here, that's the water molecule, and you can see that it's small enough to fit through this pore right here. Right? It can zip right through there. But the solute molecule is too big. It won't fit through. Right? So what about the blue? Which way does it want to move? From right to left or left to right? Left to right. And how can you tell? How do you know? Because of the number of particles on the left is a lot higher than on the right, so it's going to move down a concentration gradient, and it can move through this membrane because it can fit through these pores. Now, what about the solute molecule? Is it going to want to move one way or another? Okay. It's going to want to move because of what? There is a concentration gradient, but even though there's a concentration gradient, can it move? It can't because the membrane is impermeable to it. Okay, so this membrane right here is what we call, what, a selectively permeable, or you could call that a semi-permeable membrane, either one. All right, so water diffuses down its concentration gradient. Water is less concentrated where there are more solute molecules. And where's that? That's over here on the right side of this beaker, right? The water concentration is less here than on the left because there's more solutes over here. These solutes, okay, have to be osmotically active for osmosis to take place. And what we mean by that is that these parts, in order to be osmotically active, it means that they can't equalize their concentration on either side of this membrane because they're prevented from going across it. They're stuck on one side. If the solute molecules are stuck on one side of the membrane, they are what we call osmotically active. All right, so that's going to draw water from left to right in this particular circumstance right here. Okay, so let's consider now another setup. We have two compartments separated by a selectively permeable membrane, and we change the concentration of water and also the solute. In this particular case, we're going to use glucose. Glucose can't get across the membrane because it's too big. Water is small enough, it can get across. Notice we have a lot more water on the left than on the right. So the concentration gradient for water is high on the left, low on the right. And so that's going to draw water into the right-hand side compartment. Initially, they started both at the same volume, X. Water is going to move in, and when it moves into the right-hand compartment, it's going to push the membrane over to the left until the water concentration has equalized on both sides of this membrane, at which time then the concentration of glucose is the same on both sides of the membrane. So what has changed here? This volume of these two compartments have changed, right? One has gotten bigger and the other has gotten smaller. All right, so some living membranes have certain kinds of channels in them because water necessarily can't get through the plasma membrane because of this oil layer right here. So it needs a channel to go through. We call those aquaporins. Those are special proteins that allow water to go through the membrane. Okay. All right, so it's kind of funny to see this membrane move over. And when we have a selectively permeable membrane with a concentration across it, that exerts a pressure that we call osmotic pressure. And osmotic pressure is the amount of force that we would have to push on the membrane to get it back so that both volumes of this apparatus were equal. All right, so when water diffused over, right, that pushed the membrane to the left, how much force do we have to push back to the right to get it to its original position right here? And that force is proportional to the solute concentration. All right? And that indicates how strongly water wants to diffuse through that particular membrane right here. Okay. Well, I want to stop and just talk about how we mix up different kinds of solutions and how we talk about them and why we use a certain kind of terminology in biology. All right, so here, let's talk about the difference between molarity and molality. And let's mix up a one molar solution of something. And so here's a one molar solution of glucose. So glucose is the, what is that? It's the solute. And what is the solvent. It's going to be water, right? And so to mix a one molar solution, we get exactly 1 mole of glucose, right, and put it in this beaker, and then we fill the beaker up to exactly the 1 liter mark. All right, now what the heck is a mole of glucose? A mole of anything is this number of particles, and that's a really huge number because molecules are what? Extremely small, right? So you need billions and billions of molecules to make a mole. 6 × 10²³ power, that's a huge number. And if you look at the periodic table, right, if you add up the elements that make glucose, what are the elements that make glucose? You got carbon, you got 6 carbons, and you got some hydrogens, you got 12 hydrogens, and then you got 6 oxygens, and if you add the weights of those elements together, then you get the molecular weight of glucose, which is 180 grams per this number of particles, or grams per mole. And then you put that in 1 liter, or you mix it up for 1 liter, that gives you a 1 molar solution of glucose. Okay. Well, you can see that if you use really tiny molecules, maybe like sodium, which is really, really small, you get the same number of particles. How much water do you have to add to fill this beaker up to the 1 liter mark? Is it the exact same amount as glucose, or more or less? Okay. Because sodium is a lot smaller, you would have to add a lot more water to mix a 1 molar solution of sodium compared to glucose. So the ratio of water to sodium molecules is not the same as the ratio of glucose to water molecules. So molarity is not a good way to talk about osmotic properties of something. A better way of talking about it is with a molal solution. And with a molal solution, you take exactly 1 mole of glucose, which is what we did in the first case, but now instead of adding a different amount of water, depending on the substance that you're adding to the beaker, you add exactly 1 liter, which is exactly 1 kilogram. 1 liter of water, by definition, is 1 kilogram. And when we add 1 kilogram of solvent and 1 mole of solute, what do we have? More than 1 liter of solution. But if we do it that way, we always know the correct ratio of solute to solvent, right? And that would be a 1 molal solution. Because for osmotic properties are only dependent upon the number of particles that are in solution. Okay. All right, so there's another term that we have to be familiar with, and that is osmolality as well. Okay. So, for instance, if we take glucose and put it in water, so we mix up a 1 molal solution of glucose and a 1 molal solution of sodium chloride, the ratio of these solutes to solvent are exactly the same, right, because we're using the molality way of mixing compounds up. Okay, when you put glucose in water, does it break apart? Does it dissociate? No, it just dissolves. It just dissolves in water, but it doesn't break apart into any kind of particles. You just have glucose that's dissolved in water. But what about sodium chloride? It's held together with what kind of bonds? Ionic bonds. They're weak, and when you put it in water, that breaks the ionic bond. So now for every sodium chloride that you put in water, how many particles do you get? You get 2, right? So because sodium chloride dissociates, the water concentration over here is half compared to what it is over here because the solute concentration is double, right? Because sodium chloride dissociates into 2 particles. So the way we talk about that, even though the molality is the same, right? Since we're interested in the number of particles, we have to talk about the osmolality. So for glucose, because it doesn't dissociate, a 1 molal solution is equal to a 1 osmolar solution, right? But for sodium chloride, because it breaks into 2 particles, that turns into a 2 osmolar solution. All right, and because this is twice as concentrated over here, which way is water going to move? It's going to move from left to right, and this membrane, of course, is going to move over here, and that's because of that dissociation of sodium and chloride, until the concentration is exactly the same on either side of this membrane right here. Okay. All right, so let's talk about tonicity for a little bit. So this is very important clinically. So I'm going to erase my car. Brings back a lot of really good memories. Fixing that car in the dead of winter time. Okay, so let's take a beaker right here and let's put a cell inside that beaker, like a red blood cell, which is a nice round, smooth kind of cell. It's got a little dimple in it. And inside this cell, and as a matter of fact, pretty much all living cells have a solute concentration of about 0.9%, right? NaCl. And this NaCl can't get across the membrane. It gets bonked out, right? And then the remainder of the contents of this cell is water. So how much water is inside a typical cell? It's going to be 100% minus 0.9, which is 99.1% H2O. And there are pores in this membrane right here that allow water to move back and forth across the membrane. Okay. All right, so let's put this cell in pure water. What's the percentage of pure water in pure water? It's 100%, right? Okay. So we have 100% H2O in the beaker. And which way is water going to diffuse? It's always going to go from high to low. What's higher, 100% or 99.1? 100% is higher. It doesn't look like it's that big a number, that big a difference, but in terms of this cell, that's a huge difference. So much water is going to enter the cell that it's going to change the shape of that cell. What's going to happen to it? Got to get bigger. And then eventually, that's so much osmotic pressure that the cell is going to explode. We call that hemolysis. All right. So this cell is going to hemolyze. I'll say hemolysis is the process. Okay, and then the other thing we got to know is what do we call this solution right here? All right, this solution is allowing the cell to expand, so that means the pressure on the outside is decreasing. So this is what we call what is the word we use for below or less than? Hypo. Right, so the solution is hypotonic because the cell is expanding and even hemolyzing. So a hypotonic solution, right? Water rushes into the cell, it expands, and it bursts open. That's a hypotonic solution. Now let's take that cell, all right, and let's put it in seawater. And let's just say seawater is 5% salt. How much water then is in there? 95, right? 95% H2O. And I forget, inside the cell is what? 0.9% salt? Can salt go across the membrane? Cannot. What about water? 99.1% H2O. Water can go. Now which way, how does water move? Again, by diffusion from high to low. What's higher, 95 or 99.1? Yeah, 99.1. So water is going to leave the cell. What happens to the shape? It shrinks, and that process is what we call crenation. I think maybe you guys did this in lab last week, maybe Monday. No, you don't come to lab on Monday. Maybe last week you did that. It crenates when the cell becomes all jagged and spiky like that. That's crenation. And the solution, the way we talk about this solution right here, we say the solution is what? Pressing in on the cell. This is... what's the word we use for more? Hyper, right? Hypertonic. That's a hypertonic solution. And then, of course, there is the one last case where we have this cell, 0.9% salt, 99.1% water right here. And let's put it in 0.9% salt and 99.1% water. Which way is water going to diffuse? Water is always going to go from high to low. And what's higher, 99.1 or 99.1? They're both the same, right? So water is not going to move one way or the other. Or a better way of saying that, for every water molecule that leaves, one enters, because the force is the same. So, since the force is the same, we call this isotonic solution. Okay, so when you're given an IV or intravenous drugs or something like that, do you think it matters what the tonicity of the solution is? Yeah, which one would you pick for yourself? Isotonic, because you don't want to hemolyze any red blood cells. This is irreversible. This is an irreversible process. Like if I have a balloon and I blow so much air into it that it pops, you can't ever get that balloon back together again, right? So these cells are forever destroyed. And of course, you don't want to have your cells crenated because they'll shrivel up and they won't carry oxygen and they'll get stuck, right, in your vascular system. This is not irreversible because if we rehydrate somebody, those cells will do what? They'll expand back to their original shape, right? But that's still pretty much just as dangerous. But of course, this is the best condition, right? You don't want to destroy the shape of those cells at all. Isotonic solution is the best. All right, so on the slide above, I guess here it is. I wasn't showing you that. Here is just a normal cell in an isotonic solution. Right? Here's a cell that has crenated because it's in a hypertonic solution. Water has been pulled out of it. And here is a cell that's in a hypotonic solution. It is swelling up and it's getting ready to hemolyze. It's going to burst. Right? Okay. So, how are you going to remember this? Even if you can't remember this whole discussion, for instance, if I don't give this lecture in about 50 years, I can still talk about it properly. There's a little trick I use that might be okay for you guys to know. You should really understand what's going on here, but you want to hear my trick? Okay. Well, look, there's an O in hemolysis right here, and there's an O in hypotonic. All right, there's an E in crenation, there's an E in hypertonic right here. So I don't know if that helps you out at all. It might. All right, so just double check if you answer it right on your test if you have a question like that. But don't tell anybody I told you to think about it that way. Okay. All right, so for instance, now here's a good question. Do the above processes qualify as osmosis? What are the three criteria for osmosis? All right, so I tell you what, what's a solution again? It's a solvent plus solute. Okay, so for something to be osmosis, number one, it has to be diffusion. Let's see if I can remember this. Diffusion. Now, what does that mean? Something going from high to low. What about energy? No energy required. Is that true here so far? Yeah. Okay. And number two, it's got to be the solvent molecule. What is diffusing here? Yeah, and what's that? Is that a solvent? Yeah. So number two is satisfied as well. And then the third criteria, what's the third criteria? I have it upside down on your sheet, so you'll have to stand on your head to read it. It has to go across a semi-permeable membrane. So there has to be a membrane that the solvent molecule is diffusing across, but it's a special membrane. It's got to be semi-permeable membrane. And is this a semi-permeable membrane? It's a membrane. Is it semi-permeable?
Yes.
Because why? Because the salt can't get out, right? It only lets water. So that means that salt is osmotically active, right? If salt could move through the membrane, okay, then it's not osmotically active. It wouldn't pull so much water in because the salt could move out. All right, so these are the three criteria for osmosis, and that's osmosis that we just looked at, okay, because they're living cells. All right. So we go to 1250. Okay. All right, so let's look and see how important that is and how that's regulated in your body. All right, so blood osmolality is maintained in a normal range, or a very narrow range, about 300 milliosmolar. That's the normal concentration all right, of water in or solutes in your blood. If dehydration occurs, there are osmoreceptors that measure the concentration of salt or water in your body in the hypothalamus. And they stimulate the release of a hormone called antidiuretic hormone. All right, so what does a diuretic do? What does a diuretic do? I don't know if you have a feel for this, but a diuretic makes you? Yeah, it makes you pee. All right, so if diuretic makes you pee, an antidiuretic does what? Yeah, it prevents you from peeing. It retains water in your body, right? So that's the job of ADH. Right? It causes the kidney to conserve water, but ADH also gives you the sensation that you're thirsty. So what it precipitated this? Right? Dehydration or an increase in osmolality of the of your body. So dehydration. When you dehydrate, you lose blood volume. That increases osmolality of your blood, makes your blood more salty. Ah, how's the osmolality of your blood? That stimulates the hypothalamus. Where's the hypothalamus at? That's in your brain, right? That's in your brain. All right, so then it signals the posterior pituitary to release ADH. ADH, it's a hormone. It goes to the kidneys, and it causes the kidney to retain water, to resorb water from urine or the filtrate that's a precursor of urine so that you don't lose it from your body. All right. The other thing that the hypothalamus does is that it gives you the sensation of thirst. And when you're thirsty, you intake water. That increases your water intake. And this feeds back to the original stimulus, which was what? Increased blood plasma osmolality. So these things then will dilute your blood and bring it back to normal. So this is a nice classical case where the response here subtracts from the stimulus, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so here, this is an exam figure, so you should know all of these different things right here. All right, what did I give you? I think I start with dehydration. All right, that would cause decreased blood volume and increased plasma osmolality. Okay, so that's done with ADH. All right, so let's talk about transport mechanisms across a plasma membrane. There might be molecules that are too large or maybe too polar to go across the plasma membrane or just to diffuse through it, right? Because that's a phospholipid bilayer. So some molecules must bind to a membrane protein. And when they're transported, we would call that a carrier protein. But it's got to bind to that protein first. So carrier-mediated transport has a number of characteristics that describe that particular process. All right, so don't forget, the molecule that's moving across the membrane has to bind to a protein that's actually going across the membrane before it can be transported. All right, so the carrier protein, right, or the protein carrier, exhibit these three characteristics. The first one here is specificity. All right. In order for a molecule, the molecule that's being carried, before it can bind to the protein, right, there has to be a certain relationship between the active site of the carrier protein and the molecule that's being transported. And the way that we understand the relationship is by the size and the shape. The shape of the molecule that is being transported has to be complementary to the shape of the binding site on the carrier protein. Otherwise, they won't bind. So if the molecule that's being transported is a square and the binding site is triangular, the molecule can't bind to the binding site and it won't be transported across the membrane. And because of that, we say that transport process is very specific. The molecule has to have the right shape in order to be transported across. All right, so that's specificity. The other thing is competition. So for instance, we learned a name of a couple monosaccharides. What are some monosaccharides that we learned about so far? Glucose is one, galactose is another one. They have similar shape, but just two is fine, right? They're different sugars, but they're both monosaccharides. They have a little bit different shape, but they're still fairly similar. right? And since they have a similar shape, they both can bind to the binding site on a transporter molecule. So that just means that there is competition. So if glucose binds to the transporter, galactose can't. Or if galactose gets there first, what about glucose? It's left off, right? Okay. And then the other thing is saturation. The other attribute is saturation. When all the carrier proteins are occupied with, say, for instance, a glucose molecule, then the maximum rate of transport across the membrane just levels off. So what's one way of thinking about that? Well, maybe we all were going to hop in a bus to go to the beach or something and do a look at some wetlands or something, okay? And there's only one bus, right? And the bus can take 50 students at a time. And when the bus is all filled up and you got maybe a couple hundred students that want to go, then what happens to the remaining students? They just have to wait until the bus comes back because the bus is saturated, right, with students. So this is how we view it in a graphical form. If we look at the rate of transport of X, X is the molecule that's moving across the membrane, versus the concentration of X, right? As the concentration increases, we see that the rate of transport increases. Let's just look at the solid line right here. All right, so as the concentration increases, the rate of transport increases. But what happens when the concentration goes way beyond the capacity of that transporter to transport it? If all the transporters now have molecule X associated with them, what happens to the rate of transport? It just levels off. So even further increases in concentration of X, the transporters can't transport anymore because they're all busy doing their job transporting X across the membrane. So this flat part right here, this plateau, is what we call saturation. And this rate, because here's the rate on this axis right here, this is the maximum transport rate. Sometimes we just call that T sub M. So if your cell wants to increase T sub M, right, and if concentration is increasing, how could a cell increase the maximum transport rate? It just has to build more transporters and put it in the membrane, right? And then T sub M will increase. All right, now let's look at the rate, the T sub M of X when there's competition. Okay? What happens now if there are two molecules, like glucose and galactose? And don't forget, this Y can bind to the transporter membrane, and when Y is bound to it, what about X? It's left off. And if it can't bind to the transporter, it doesn't get transported across the membrane. So when there is competition, right, the maximal rate decreases. And you see that with the dotted line curve right here. Okay, so that's what that graph shows. All right, let's look at it in terms of an illustration. So here we see the nice phospholipid bilayer right here. And here we have some glucose. What can you tell me about glucose? What kind of domain does it like to dissolve in? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophilic. Loves to dissolve in water because of all those hydroxyl groups. But because it's a very polar kind of compound, it can't get through this lipid layer of the membrane. All right, so we see high concentration of glucose outside the cell and low inside. Which way does glucose want to diffuse? It wants to go from high to low, which in this particular case is from outside to inside. But if there are no transporters, will it do that? It can't because of that lipid layer right in the center of the plasma membrane. So there are transporters that are inserted into the membrane. So remember, the shape of a monosaccharide kind of looks like a stop sign. So the binding site of this transporter has to be complementary in shape, right? So it's going to bind right here. And when it binds to this protein right here, there is enough energy in the gradient to cause a change in conformation of this protein. We see it's open first to the outside of the cell. When glucose binds, it changes conformation, so now it's going to be open to the inside of the cell and closed to the outside. All right, so how should you think about binding of glucose to this binding site right here? Lock and key, yeah, because they have to be complementary in nature. But for instance, why does it change the conformation and kind of a nice way that I think about it is if you're sitting there taking notes, okay, and somebody takes their finger and pokes it in your side, what are you going to do? Are you just going to sit there, or what's going to happen to you? You're going to change conformation, right? So think of this glucose, when it binds to the active site right here, it's perturbing the shape of that transporter molecule. It's going to change conformation because what is determining this structure of the protein? Like ionic bonds, hydrogen bonds within that molecule, which are what kind of bonds? Really weak kind of bonds. So when it gets poked in the side, it can undergo a conformation change pretty easily. And the energy for that is the concentration gradient. All right, so you see glucose needs this transporter to enter a cell. Glucose can't enter cells all by itself. All right, and what is the hormone that's necessary to allow the uptake of glucose from outside the cell? Insulin, that's right. Insulin is the passport. All right, so here's an interesting mechanism that is controlled by insulin. Here is a vesicle inside the cell, and you see that this vesicle is loaded with membrane proteins, which are carrier proteins, and in particular for glucose. That looks like a little glucose binding site right there. All right, and this is now inside the cell, and since it's inside the cell, can this cell take up glucose? No, because the transporters are not in the plasma membrane. All right, so in order for this cell to take up glucose, insulin has to bind to a receptor molecule, and then there has to be signals inside the cell that tell this endosome, it's a vesicle containing these transporters, to fuse with the plasma membrane. And when it does, guess where you have these transporter molecules now? In the cell membrane. And so glucose can go from high concentration to low concentration, and the cell can take up glucose as a result of that insulin signal. So when we look at the various cellular organelles, I didn't mention endosome, but an endosome is a special kind of vesicle. It doesn't contain lysozyme, doesn't contain peroxidase like a peroxisome would or what a lysosome does. It just holds these membrane components until it gets the proper signal to insert them into the plasma membrane that then gives the cell the ability to take up glucose. So that's why I say the function of an endosome is for storing membrane proteins and then for routing those proteins depending on the signaling molecules that will insert that into the plasma membrane right here. And of course that signaling molecule is going to be insulin, right? And when is insulin secreted in your body? When you're in a fasted state or a fed state? When you're in a fed state, when your blood glucose increases, right? Under normal circumstances. Okay. Oh, now, what about this right here? Is this an active process or passive process? It's passive because glucose is just going down its concentration gradient. But it still needs what? That insulin signal in order for it to operate, in order to insert these transporters into the membrane. I'll mention this again. There's another signal that inserts these transporters into the membrane besides insulin, and that is exercise. When you exercise a muscle, these glucose transporters get put into the cell membrane. And so that's why they always say for somebody that has diabetes, what should you do? Exercise, because that is like the passport for cells to take up glucose. All right, I'll mention that again. All right, so here is another circumstance, all right, but this is going to be active transport. We have here's the plasma membrane. Here's the intracellular space. Here's the extracellular. Calcium is high outside. Calcium ion is high outside the cell. It's low inside. And cells like to have it that way. So it's always going to be trying to kick calcium out of the cell. But will calcium diffuse out of the cell all by itself? No, because it's low inside, it's high outside. What do we call that process of going from low to high concentration? Active transport, and the molecule you need is ATP. You need an energy source, right? All right, so again, here's a transporter for calcium, and calcium can enter this location, bind right here to the carrier protein, and then it needs a second molecule to bind to the carrier protein, namely ATP. binds right here, and then ATP is broken down into inorganic phosphate and ADP plus something else. What's the third thing that's not on this slide? I should actually draw that in. Okay. When ATP is broken down into ADP and inorganic phosphate, the third thing that's produced is energy, right? Free energy. Energy is just the ability to do work. So that changes a conformation in this protein. So now it's closed to the inside and open to the outside, and then so calcium finds its way on the outside of the cell. So what changes the conformation right here is the release of energy when ATP is hydrolyzed. So this is what we call active transport. So when things go from low concentration to high, or when this protein in the membrane can move things from low concentration to high using ATP, sometimes we call that a pump. All right, so here is a pump that's inserted into the membrane that's pumping calcium from low concentration to high. So have you ever seen a well, an old-time well, to get water out of the ground that didn't have an electric motor on it? What would you have to do? Had this big long handle, and you would have to pump it, right? You'd have to move it up and down. And so water would go from low in the ground to high above the ground. That requires energy to do that. So that's where they get the name of pump in this particular circumstance. Here is a very important kind of pump that all cells have. So when you say pump, what should you automatically be thinking about? Active or passive? Active. And the energy source is ATP. All right, so this is the sodium potassium ATP pump, or you could call it sodium potassium pump. In living cells, potassium is high on the inside and it's low on the outside. So you're going to have to remember these things. I'll go over it again with you. Sodium, on the other hand, is the reverse. It's low on the inside but high on the outside. So will sodium automatically diffuse outside the cell? Will it diffuse out of the cell? If it's high outside, low inside, it won't. Right? The concentration gradient is going the wrong way. What about for potassium? Will potassium diffuse inside the cell? No, because it's going against the concentration gradient. So in order for these ions to move against their concentration gradient, what do you need? ATP. So there is a special membrane protein, right, that can hydrolyze ATP, and it can move potassium to the inside of the cell and sodium on the outside. That help maintains potassium high on the inside and sodium high on the outside. And it doesn't pump equal amounts. It pumps 2 potassium for every 3 sodium. So it's unequal distribution. All right, so the sodium potassium ATP pump is 3 sodium for 2 potassium. All right, so you're pumping more positive charges. This will give you a little foreshadowing of some important electrical properties of the cell. If this pump is pushing out more positive ions outside the cell compared to positive ions being moved inside the cell, can you see that the inside of the cell becomes more negative? Right? If it was equal, right, then you would have an even distribution of charge. But since you're moving more sodiums out than potassiums in, the inside of the cell gets more negative. All right, so in a resting state, what do I want you to know in terms of ion concentration? Where is calcium high in a resting cell, outside or inside? It's going to be high outside the cell. What about sodium, high inside or outside? High outside. And potassium, where is that going to be high? Inside the cell. So you should have a really good feel for that. Okay. All right, let's talk about another transport process, and this is what we call secondary active transport. What we are looking at right here, I'm going to go back to the previous slide. Where's that sign-in sheet? It's a yellow sheet. Where's that at? Yeah, did everybody sign it back there? Yeah, pass it down to the front. I didn't have time because of the disaster drill to print a fancy one out, but maybe next time. Because I do want you to check to make sure that you're officially registered for the class. All right, so next time I'll have the updated roll sheet as of Monday. Okay, but today you just got to sign the sheet. All right, so getting back to this sodium-potassium pump, what molecule is directly being used up to move these ions across the membrane? It's going to be ATP, right? ATP is being used up in order to move these molecules across. Another way of talking about this as being active transport, we would call this primary active transport. Primary active transport is when ATP is directly being used up. That's primary active transport, as opposed to this kind of active transport, which we call secondary active transport. All right, so let me describe secondary active transport to you. All right, so in order to move things from low concentration to high, you need energy. You need some kind of energy source. And for primary active transport, what is that? It is ATP, right? In a diagram, you're going to see an ATP molecule somehow getting used up. You're automatically going to say primary active transport, right? Because ATP is there. But there's another way things can move around against the concentration gradient, and it's not through the use of ATP. It's through the use of another concentration gradient, right? All right, so secondary active transport requires ATP to move, for instance, a first molecule of sodium uphill to create a gradient. What does that mean? Sodium is going to move from low concentration to high concentration. ATP is going to be used. All right, so if ATP is used, what do we call that process? That is primary active transport. And once sodium gets up here because it's using ATP, what will it automatically do? It will want to go back down its concentration gradient, just like my car, right, on top of the hill. It's going to want to roll downhill. All right, but there are special mechanisms inside cells that utilize this energy of sodium sitting on top of this big hill. It lets it fall down the hill, but it couples it with another mechanism that we see on this illustration as being this teeter-totter right here. And when sodium falls off this cliff, it picks up kinetic energy, hits the teeter-totter. What's going to happen to the teeter-totter? It's going to flip. And if there is a glucose molecule right here, what happens to this glucose? It goes flying up into the air. It goes from low concentration to high concentration. All right, but do you see any ATP being used right here? What's the energy source? The energy source is just the motion of sodium going down its concentration gradient. So whenever you see a gradient, there is energy there. Doesn't have to be ATP. ATP developed the gradient, and that energy is stored in the gradient. The sodium gradient can be used to move glucose from low concentration to high. And since you don't see ATP being used, we call this secondary active transport. Now, will glucose go from low concentration to high concentration all by itself? It can't, right? It needs energy to do that. And where is that energy at? It's in the gradient of sodium, the sodium gradient concentration. All right, so secondary active transport, you're never going to see an ATP. You're going to see what? A chemical gradient of some kind of molecule. So secondary active transport requires energy in the form of a chemical gradient. All right, so that's the big difference. So I think you'll be able to train your eyes pretty quick to see that. If you see ATP being hydrolyzed, what kind of active transport is that? Primary. If it's just a gradient that's being used, that is secondary active transport, and of course you're not going to see ATP being used. Okay, we talk about secondary active transport mechanisms. We classify them as they can be a couple different things, right? They can be either symport or antiport. That's what I call them. Your book calls them co-transport or counter-transport. So for secondary active transport, remember, how many things are moving around? You have sodium as well as glucose. You have two things moving, right? They're coupled together. Right, so you have two things moving. If they move in the same direction, we call that co-transport. All right, so secondary transport, both molecules move in the same direction. Sodium and glucose move in the same direction, that's symport. Right? Or, like in this example, what's the direction? They looked opposite. right? They look like they're going in opposite directions. We call that counter transport or antiport. I like antiport. It's a smaller word. So a molecule moves in opposite directions to sodium gradient. That is what we call an antiport system. So let's look at this right here. So here we see sodium and glucose, and glucose is high on the inside of the cell. So glucose is high. Will glucose want to diffuse into the cell if it's high inside the cell? It doesn't want to. What kind of transport mechanism do you need to get glucose to move into the cell if it's high on the inside? Some kind of active transport, right? But now, do you see any ATP in this illustration right here? So can it be primary active transport? Nope. It's got to be secondary active transport. And for secondary active transport, where is that energy coming from? A chemical gradient. And what do we have? Where is sodium normally high? Outside the cell, low inside the cell, so sodium wants to diffuse in. And here is a special kind of membrane protein that has a binding site for sodium as well as glucose. When they both bind, what's that like? Somebody poking you with two fingers? All right. It changes conformation, so now it closes to the outside, opens to the inside, and both glucose and sodium enter the cell. Glucose is going from low concentration to high. Sodium is going from high to low, and there is enough energy to move glucose inside the cell. So this is a really good example of secondary active transport, and that takes us to this exam figure right here. So I'm going to describe it a little bit and then start probably here next time as well. Yeah. I would say literally the same direction. So for instance, both sodium, I should have mentioned that on this slide, okay? So both sodium and glucose are going, what, in the same direction? So would this be an example of co-transport or counter-transport? Co-transport, because they're both going in the same direction in this particular case, right? So this would be symport mechanism. All right, so here is, let's talk about transport across an epithelial membrane. All right, so what kind of epithelium does this look like right here? It's way back from like the first week of anatomy, second week of anatomy. This is just a simple cuboidal epithelium, right? These look like kind of cuboidal cells to me, one layer thick. And we find these kinds of cells in kidney tubules. So for instance, if this is the filtrate that's eventually going to become urine and excreted from your body, this is the kind of epithelium that exists in a kidney tubule. Or this could be an epithelium of your digestive system, in which particular case it wouldn't be cuboidal, actually it would be a columnar cell, if you can remember that. But so here is, think of this as either being a simple cuboidal or columnar epithelium. All right, and so here is some glucose. This could be, end up in the urine, right, because this is the filtrate, or this could end up outside your body if that's your digestive tract. But glucose is an important energy molecule. Your body wants to, right, absorb it, right, because it's important energy molecule. So we want to take glucose, which is low concentration in the lumen of this tube, and put it at high concentration inside the blood. Will that automatically happen? Will it go from low to high automatically by diffusion? Nope. We need active transport of some kind to get glucose inside our bodies. All right. Now, sodium is high in the lumen right here. Sodium is high on the outside of these cells. So what does sodium want to do? It wants to diffuse into the cell. Here is a special membrane protein that can bind both sodium and glucose, just like the previous slide. All right, so glucose gets dragged into high concentration inside the cell due to this co-transport. Now, what kind of transport is co-transport? We see glucose going from low to high, so we know it is active, but what kind of active transport is it? It's secondary active transport, because do you see any ATP here? No, no ATP. Secondary active transport. Now we have glucose at high concentration inside the cell, low in the blood, but don't forget, glucose can't get through that hydrophobic region right here, so there's got to be a transporter for it. All right? That's what we call facilitated diffusion, because glucose will readily go from high to low, it just needs help with that facilitated diffuser protein inside the membrane. So glucose ends up in the blood just like we wanted, going from low concentration to high concentration in the blood. Now what about the sodium? Sodium goes from high to low. How does a cell maintain a low concentration of sodium inside the cell? It uses the sodium potassium ATP pump. Right? So it exchanges three sodiums, kicks three sodium out. It grabs two potassiums inside the cell, so it maintains sodium at a really low concentration. But sodium is going from low concentration to high. What kind of mechanism is used to go from low to high? Active transport. You need some kind of active transport mechanism. And this right here, what kind of active transport is this? You know, two kinds. It's either going to be primary or secondary. So because you see ATP, that's primary active transport. So this is the protein that drives what? This whole system. Here's the primary active transport setting up this secondary active transport mechanism on the apical surface of the cell, right? So you can see that this cell is polar in nature. The proteins in the apical surface are a lot different than the proteins in the basolateral surface over here to get this mechanism to work properly. All right, so next time, remind me to start here next time, okay? Okay, look at your notes before next time too and start working on some of those homework things. And ask me a lot of questions next time. Okay.
Are you going to have it ready by
then? Parts of it. Yeah.
That way I get an idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to have you have access to Blackboard, but it just hasn't happened.
Okay.
You know, like for the study guides and things like that. But Thursday we can talk. Thursday morning. Yeah.
During transcription, is RNA polymerase responsible for unzipping the DNA?
There's actually...
Helicase?
Yeah, helicase is the one that does that.
Okay.
Helicase unzips it and untwists it so it doesn't get all jumbled up.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, where's that sign-in sheet at? Oh, here it is. Hi. Oh, yeah? Was I nice or did I blow you off the road? Oh, good. I got to go get my notes for class.
No test today?
No test today. It's Thursday.
The fire thing was earlier, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be Thursday. We got to finish up some things today.
upstairs to the bio club and claim your pizza yesterday?
No, I never did. Oh, did I have any for me? Did I have my name on it? Dang.
I don't know if Adele saved you any slices or
no,
not.
No, probably not.
But,
no.
No,
I didn't make it up there. The next time I'll try harder.
Yeah, well, I told them, since I went up there and told them a week from Thursday at 2 o'clock that the students are trying to pull together a potluck out in the hallway. Another one in celebration of Darwin's 200.
Mm-hmm.
And,
man, he's an old fart.
You guys are welcome to show up. You know, it's after
yeah.
the lecture, too. The ones who
yeah.
have my test can show up.
Just hang out.
Yep. I'm not going to feed them in the lab room, though. That's good.
They could get sick and die.
Yeah.
We need students. We shouldn't kill them off.